Okay, thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see the full audience here today. I'm going to call to order a meeting on the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, April 3rd, 2017, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 828, and I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 828 is sponsored by Senators Dembrow and Taylor and Representatives Kenny Geyer, Holvey, Leininger, Nost, and Parrish. And the Senate Workforce Committee had a public hearing on it on February 27, 2017. It has two amendments, so I'll tell you what's in the original that's still there and then each of the amendments. So the original, for all employers, it establishes an employee right to request specific work schedules, establishes unlawful employment practice of discriminating or retaliating against employee who exercises rights under the Act, provides a private right of action and administrative remedies for violations. And for certain large employers, it establishes requirements for employee scheduling by retail, hospitality, and food service establishments with a specified minimum number of employees. It requires a certain large requires certain large employers to provide employee a written good faith estimate of employee's work schedule at the time of hire and to revise annually and for significant changes due to employee availability or employer business needs. It requires an interactive process when significant change from a good faith estimate is made. It requires certain large employers to provide 14 days advance written notice of the work schedule, allows employees to decline work hours not included in the schedule, and requires employers to compensate employees for schedule changes with less than 14 days advance notice unless exceptions apply. For employees of certain large employers, it establishes the right to rest between work shifts and requires employers to provide extra compensation for hours worked when fewer than 10 hours separate shifts. It requires certain large employers to offer additional hours to existing employees before hiring new employees or subcontractors, and it requires the labor commissioner to create and distribute a poster giving notice of rights in this act. The Dash 3 amendment replaces the bill. It removes definitions of career-related educational or training program and family member. It adds a definition of full-service restaurant. It clarifies that the Act is not intended to provide employees additional wages or a cause of action for voluntarily trading shifts or a cause of action for work schedule changes necessary for employee accommodation under certain state or federal laws. It establishes the name Fair Work Week Act. For all employers, it removes provisions concerning on-call pay. It applies the same provisions to all employers concerning employee right to input into work schedules. It removes some employer record-keeping requirements. For certain large employers, it expands the application of provisions concerning large employers to retail, hospitality, and food service establishments and full-service restaurants employing 25 or more employees in the state. It removes some provisions concerning employee right to input into work schedule. It modifies the requirement concerning language of good faith estimate of work schedule and notice of additional work hours available to existing employees. It removes a provision concerning pattern or practice of underscheduling. It authorizes an employer to hire new employees from external applicant pools or subcontractors immediately after the minimum posting period if no employee accepts an offer of additional hours within 2 calendar days of posting or less if necessary for timely work performance, and clarifies that an employer may consider seniority in offering additional work hours to existing employees. The Dash 4 amendment is the same as the Dash 3, except it adds it amends the section concerning access to hours for existing employees of large employers. It requires the employer to post written notice of available hours for work at least 3 consecutive calendar days and to give the employee at least 2 consecutive calendar days to accept additional work hours. And it clarifies when certain large employers may hire new employees from an external applicant pool or subcontractor to work additional hours, including no employee responds to a written notice of additional hours within 3 days or accepts an offer of additional hours within 2 days of responding to the notice, or an employer has a bona fide business reason for immediately hiring an additional employee.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think we're going to go ahead and call up Michael Savaggio and Rachel Deutsch. And we will bring Rebecca Camberling, please. Just as a reminder, everyone, if everyone can state their name and who they're with, that would be great.
Rachel, do you want to?
You first.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio. I'm here representing the Oregon Working Families Party. I have a short presentation that can kind of just quickly go through the provisions of the measure. I'll move this towards me a little bit. And in the interest of time, because we have so many people signed up to testify, I'm just going to go right through Senate Bill 828 as amended by the dash 3 and 4 amendments. And as your committee staff noted, they're strikingly similar except for Section 8. So first thing, the measure structure is it's over 20 pages, but it's a relatively simple structure here. We've got your first two sections numbering definitions, and then we've got some sections that apply strictly to large businesses, and I'll go over that definition shortly. We've only got a scant two sections that apply to all businesses, and one of those sections is the general notice and posting requirement that any business would ordinarily be subject to. And then we've got the usual boilerplate of BOLI enforcement, legislative intent, captions, etc. This document is on OLIS. It's a more detailed explanation of what's in the dash threes and fours. I believe it was delivered to the committee members' offices as well as provided to committee staff. But anyone, I think, at this point can get that off of the OLIS website.
Pardon me, Michael, I just want to clarify. So the document that you just had up, the checklist?
Yes.
That with the dash four, nothing changes, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
To further clarify, Madam Chair, the hard copy that everyone should have and that has been submitted to OLIS has added dash four to that to make that abundantly clear.
Okay.
It's just lagging on my PowerPoint.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. So in terms of the applicability business-wise, it creates two classes of employers. There's the all-employers section, and when we say all-employers, we use a very broad definition that's already in ORS 652. The only exclusions are federal agencies, and there's some kind of complex financial instruments held in trust, but for all intents and purposes, we are including public agencies, et cetera. For large employers, there's a two-step test. The employer must have over 25 employees in Oregon, and at the same time, be in either retail, food service, or hospitality industries. Now, I'll just go through the sections generally, but I'll start at Section 9. Section 9 is the section that applies to all employers. There's a right to input. Employees have the ability to ask their employer for particular scheduling preferences. Also on OLIS, you'll see a report from PSU that was authored by Dr. Mary King. It'll describe some instances where employees went to an employer to say, I could really use this day off because I have school or I have church or something like that, and were retaliated against because the employers presumably would have liked more focus given to the job. This does not contain an obligation that the employer honors the requests, and I want to make that abundantly clear. There's no obligation on employers under this section other than to allow employees to express their preferences. And then we'll just go through number by number. Section 4, an annual good faith estimate of hours, so that the employer every year explains, here's how many hours we think you're going to get. That doesn't mean that that's not going to fluctuate little by little. That just means that it has to be a good faith estimate so that the employee knows generally what they can count on in terms of moving forward in that job, whether they're promised 30 hours a week, but it's only giving 10 hours a week or vice versa.
Pardon me, Michael, I just want to clarify. So does that mean that on the hours for the good faith estimate, that that's on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, or just a...
That's a great question. And Madam Chair, in answering that question, I'm going to slowly turn to the page that it's on.
No, it's fine. You can tell me later. You can answer later. I just was curious if it was weekly or monthly.
Advance notice of schedule. This is very similar to the good faith estimate, except now we're getting into where the employer is obligated to let the employee know what their schedule is going to be like over the next 2 weeks, 2 weeks in advance. This applies, again, only to large employers. This has got to be a little more precise because this is the advance notice that will trigger or not trigger some of these predictability pay sections later on. Section 6 gives employees the right to rest between shifts. Again, this applies only to large employers, and it says that if two shifts span two calendar days, and it only takes effect if there is a span of calendar days, then employees are given the option to take 10 hours of rest between them. For example, if I were closing a store at midnight, the employer would not be able to require me to come on shift until after 10 a.m. the next morning. That doesn't mean that I can't pick up that shift voluntarily. So I want to make it very, very clear that Section 6 sub 1 says employees can still request or volunteer for these shifts if they want to take those, because we know that there are employees that actually like taking those shifts. It works with their schedule. They like the extra money for whatever reason. Predictability pay. This is the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of the legislation. It's generally in two sections. Section 7 sub 1 sub A, again, applies to large employers, and it says that you can't call in an employee who's not already on the schedule without adding an hour to their time. Now, there are certain exceptions, and I will get to those in just with one intervening slide. There's the little note about the exceptions. And then the contrary to that, if an employee is scheduled, but they're either sent home early or told not to come in, then similar to the BOLI rule that existed from 1971 to 1987, they would be given half their scheduled hours for an unexempted cancellation. Again, there are exemptions to this and the previous rule that I'll go over now. Shift swaps. If employees want to swap shifts voluntarily, that's supposed to be employees shaking hands. I don't know if that came out right. But the reason, again, is that we know that a lot of employees, they like having the flexibility to swap shifts, and we don't want to get in the way of that. Although in the original bill it was already in Section 10 sub 2, it's an exception that's so nice we decided to write it twice because we didn't want anyone to miss it. So now in Section 14 sub 5, you will see that same clarification that we're not applying these predictability pay measures to shift swaps. So the Fair Work Week Act maintains employees' ability to swap shifts. A voluntary shift pickup. If the employer says, gosh, we've got some extra hours here, someone needs to pick this up, who wants them? That's completely fine, too. Nothing in the bill is stopping employees' ability to pick up shifts as they become available. I want to make that expressly clear. An exception for working consecutive hours. If we're getting towards closing time and an employee is already on the clock, the employer can ask them to continue working in order to meet existing customer demand or help close down. And I put the little guy's hand up there, or maybe it's a lady or non-binary gendered person, they're volunteering for that because the employer still can't mandate that the person, that the employee has to pick that up. However, if the employee is available and willing, then again, no penalty there. Employees can request additional shifts. They can request time off. They can make whatever requests they want. And if that's fine with the employer, the bill doesn't apply. Discipline. If the employee does something bad or wrong, then they can be disciplined with the loss of hours. That maintains employer's ability to cut shifts for disciplinary reasons. Dangerous situations. It was pointed out to me that I should probably clarify that that officer's not shooting the person. That's a finger. the idea is say it's dangerous here. Go away. So this would generally apply to dangerous situations. Say a situation where there is an accident. There is a building in danger of falling down, or maybe a adverse weather event. We had a significant weather event in Portland last December. There were a lot of shifts that were unexpectedly canceled because there were advice coming from public officials to say, please stay in your homes, don't be on the roads unless you have to, et cetera. That would trigger the exemption under Section 7 sub 2 in this particular case. Oh, that's not the right way. No utilities. This was a question that came up in a House committee hearing. If there's no utilities coming into a place of business, then you can't work, then there's an exception. Schedule changes in the event of power outages, water outages, etc. Natural disasters, Obviously, this one seems pretty self-explanatory. There's a terrible event or other situations outside of the employer's control. We don't expect employers to have to maintain the schedule that they wrote 2 weeks prior. Going on to Section 8.
Pardon me, Michael, yes. I just want to clarify, maybe you're going to discuss it later, but what's sure. come up in the past is people talking about weather pattern, just
yes.
you're scheduled to work wait staff at a restaurant that's largely outdoors, and turns out it's raining that Saturday, and so you get called at the last minute and said, you know, please don't come in today because it's raining and we don't expect a lot of people to show up. What happens in that scenario?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a very good question because we have had the question about weather. This bill, I would say, applies to extreme weather events where it does trigger some kind of public official warning. If we had written the bill to exempt its applicability in the event of rain, we're in Oregon, I don't think it would ever really take effect other than a couple months a year, maybe today, I guess. But we needed some kind of higher level trigger than simply bad weather. And I think that what we've hit upon is that it must achieve some kind of a disaster status or at least public official warning status.
Okay. Well, one of the other questions, well, there's all sorts of scenarios that there's industries that are dependent on weather.
Yes.
Whether I understand the comment about Oregon, well, obviously not, I mean, in Portland, I mean, obviously this is a bill that will affect people statewide. So in situations, skiing, well, this year, obviously we have a lot of snow, but if there's something, if people are up at Bachelor and all of a sudden there's no snow like they expected and they thought there would be snow by the weekend and they said, you know, no need to come in today because we only need half as many staff or whatever the situation is. Yeah, I can think of many, many examples up on the coast, you know, all sorts of industries that are somehow impacted by weather, but not necessarily to the level of natural disaster. I think that's kind of a commonsensical thing. So what would an employer still needs to do what in the case of that it's raining for a...
Oh.
I just want to know what specifically is in the bill to address it, but you're saying that weather would not be, if it's just good old-fashioned raining, you work at a restaurant on the Columbia River, and your employer says, don't bother coming in today because we don't need you to come, then can you just play out for us what happens for the employee and for the employer?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, under this bill, if the employee were scheduled and were told not to come in, then in that case, assuming that we're talking about a retail food service or hospitality with over 25 employees, the employer would be paying out half of the employee's shift for the unworked hours.
Okay, and so what kind of notice would they have to give them to not have to do that? So they have to call them 24 hours in advance, 48 hours in advance, how much time in advance?
That would have to be reflected on their schedule 2 weeks in advance, or they could work if they had some particular employee call and say, gosh, it's really raining, I'm worried that I'm not going to get enough tips or I don't really want to come in, then they could say, that's fine with me, we agree on that, and no penalty.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Did you want to say something? Okay. Section 8 is access to hours. This is the section that is subtly different between the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. What this says is that if a employer has additional hours coming online and coming available, there's a process through which they offer them to existing employees first. Now, both versions of the amendments allow for some avenue for employers to do more immediate hiring as that's necessary. The Dash 3s have a broad allowance regarding how long that notice needs to be up. If at all. The Dash 4s create more specific exemptions for bona fide business reasons, which is a definition that's already in the bill. And so I think that we would be in favor of either Dash, however, being the kind of technical wonk that I am, I kind of like the Dash 4s because I like more specificity, but again, this is the only difference in the bill, and both measures, or both versions, I should say, allow for some kind of immediate hiring path.
So you keep saying a hiring, you mean offering hours. Are you talking about the 20 hours versus 40 hours part-time versus full-time issue?
Madam Chair, no, but I will answer that question after this slight explanation. What we're talking about here in Section 8 is when additional hours become available, regardless of whether they're existing employees or part-time or full-time. The process that the default process that it calls for is for the employer to make those hours available to existing employees. We find that this greatly stabilizes schedules, but we do want there to be a path to where if an employer has a particular situation where they just can't go through this three-day-long process, like they picked up an unexpected job over the weekend or something, and they said, oh, I really need to hire someone for this particular job, then we want there to be a path for them to do that, for them to hire a whole new employee if need be. Now, again, the default process is that they go through a posting process with their existing employees. It doesn't make a distinction between whether employees are part-time or full-time, but I will say that it very clearly does not require an employer to offer overtime. In fact, it is explicit in saying that it does not require that.
Okay. All right.
Employer record keeping. So we're jumping ahead to Section 11. I'll go back to Section 10. But I'm moving ahead because this, again, applies to only large employers. So record keeping, we had that apply to all the employers in the previous versions of the bill. However, we've taken some sections out, and now it is a moot point as to whether smaller employers need to be doing record keeping. And so record keeping applying to rates of pay, hours worked, hours requested, that sort of thing. Posting and administration, sections 10 and 12 through 16 apply to all employers. Again, 10 is the informational posting, those little posters that you see on the wall in the coffee room. 12 and 16, these are boilerplate processes, how to file a complaint through BOLI, what that process means, et cetera, et cetera. And that's it. That's my little PowerPoint presentation.
Okay, great. So thank you for clarifying all those questions.
Yeah.
Do you have some questions, Senator Knope?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, how does the amendment or the dash fours affect or not affect bargaining, collective bargaining?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question. The there is a Section 14 that was originally in the original bill. I don't know if it was still 14, but in the dash fours and threes, it's 14. That's called limits to legislative intent. And subsection three there makes it explicitly clear that if there is a collective bargaining agreement in place that provides an equal or better remedy for any of these processes, then that agreement takes precedence, and that this bill does not create an additional remedy in that particular situation.
Okay. Do you have any other questions? Okay. Senator Gelser, welcome.
Thank you.
You just came in at the end of the PowerPoint. I think it's up there. I don't know if you want to look through that real quickly or not. Do you have any questions? Or okay.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes.
You asked about Section 4 as it relates to good faith estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, did you pull that up, or do you want me to just read what it says?
Sure. I've got it here.
Got it? Okay.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I'm sure Senator Knope has read, it is a weekly estimate, or I should say the estimate will be given annually for hours that the employee can be expected to work each week.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Sorry, we're doing many things up here. We're multitasking here.
I know the feeling.
Okay. Well, welcome. Did you Remind me where you came from.
My name is Rachel Deutsch. Thank you so much, Senator Taylor, and members of the committee for having me here today. And I'm an attorney with the Center for Popular Democracy. And I've played a lead role in developing the model Fair Work Week policy, as well as working with policymakers around the country to adapt it to their local circumstances and to implement it and enforce it. And so I've been able to sort of refine the policy through that those interactions, as well as engagement with technology vendors who sort of created this problem, as I will talk about briefly, as well as engaging with business owners and hourly workers. So we're all here to address a very specific problem with a very clear and targeted and tailored solution. We haven't updated our work hour standards in over a century, right? The 40-hour work week was the last time we really took a hard look at how workers experience the work week. And in that time, technology has changed a lot. So I don't know if any members of the committee had ever worked a retail job in their youth, or, you know, if you did, it probably was a very different experience than what the folks that you'll hear from today have facing them, because retail jobs and hospitality jobs were fairly stable back then. But now the large retail and food service and hospitality employers have begun using scheduling technology designed to achieve these efficiencies by automating the production of schedules and matching labor hours very precisely to customer demand. And that's a technology that's an example of what the statistician Kathy O'Neill has called a weapon of math destruction, which is like a, I know, I think it's kind of cute.
Like it.
It's a computer algorithm that's, you know, crunching big data, but relying on a very flawed model and therefore having a really large and harmful impact. The technology does not care what set schedule is produced for a particular worker, as long as overall store hours are matching expected demand. So what that means is a worker could have a shift, you know, until midnight, and then a shift starting the next morning at 6 a.m., even though there's another worker in that store who could have had the 6 a.m. shift, right? That worker is being saddled with this clopening just because that's what the computer has spit out. A worker, and this frequently happens, is scheduled for 8 hours 1 week, 40 hours the next, 16 the following week, resulting in enormous, you know, income volatility and inability to make ends meet, even though the store hours total are very, very, very stable. And so it doesn't have to be this way. The model, right, these computer models can be updated to give workers more stable and predictable and reliable schedules without even impacting business efficiency. In fact, there's a lot of research coming out there now that really shows that you gain value when you give workers more predictable and stable hours, for reasons that, you know, you can imagine. When people have more of a stake in their job and aren't experiencing enormous stress because of work fluctuations, they're more productive, there's much lower turnover, there's lower absenteeism because people aren't facing the impossible choice between, you know, do I come to work today or do I take my kid to the doctor? Or do I, you know, I mean, maybe that's less of an example here because presumably people have some protections around sick leave, but there are other things that come up where workers have no control over their schedule. We work very, very closely with the people who've created and are selling the technology that creates these schedules, and they have all told us that this software can be very easily programmed to comply with this law, and that once the model is updated, compliance is virtually automatic. But retail, hospitality, and food service employers are not going to change on their own because change is hard. We need, you know, working families in these industries really need your leadership to address issues around income volatility, around being unable to make and keep plans with their families. There are a lot of issues around people wanting to pursue their education or second jobs, but they can't make it work because they don't know when their schedule's going to allow it. And then enormous problems lining up reliable childcare or even just being there for their kids. So you're probably all familiar with the report by Professors Scott and King, but I just wanted to sort of highlight a couple things that report showed in terms of the narrowly tailored solution here. The problems that this bill addresses are really most prevalent in the hospitality and food service and retail sectors. So you'll see that the problem of clopening, of having this really short turnaround and inadequate amount of rest between your shifts, ranges between 48% and 61% in those three industries. So very, very common for those workers. over half of the respondents that worked in retail and food work part-time, and half of those are providing for family on our part-time income. And of course, the folks who work in these industries are much more likely to live in or near poverty, to lack health insurance, to rely on SNAP and other benefits, and also to be in school. Women and people of color are disproportionately represented in these industries as well. And people are more likely to be raising children in these poverty jobs than in the workforce generally. And the other important consideration is that the occupations that are covered by this bill, right, so we're talking about like retail salesperson, cashier, food service worker, housekeepers, right, this is where the economic growth is in Oregon right now. So when you target the corporate practices that are harming workers, you know, the decision to do that is really whether Oregon is going to have a strong economy that allows working families to thrive, or whether we're going to see a growing share of working families in the state that are scraping by in poverty while taxpayers are subsidizing these harmful corporate practices through programs like SNAP and the Oregon Health Plan. So we see this as a really a targeted impact in terms of the employers that it's targeting, but a really large impact in terms of what it will mean for the economy and the families of this state. So with that, I will just mention that if there's any questions that I can answer about sort of how this has played out in other places, or how the sort of why is the policy designed in the way it is, I know Michael was able to answer a bunch of those, but I'm happy to be helpful if I can.
Well, I have a question. So can you talk a little just briefly about other states, cities, other jurisdictions that have adopted this kind of legislation?
San Francisco and California, there's a small town called Emeryville that's got a lot of retail and hospitality that just enacted it in the fall. Seattle, of course, just enacted it at the same time. San Jose had a voter initiative to adopt the access to hours component around giving opportunities for part-time workers before you hire new staff. And currently, I know the Connecticut legislature is actively considering something. I mean, bills are being – like, I just got an email today that North Carolina and Ohio just introduced bills. So it's kind of it's popping up in a lot of places.
So I understand it's relatively new. And can you talk a little bit about – my understanding of this is that each of the jurisdictions are perhaps doing things a little bit differently. For example, the size of the employer, you know, city versus statewide, this kind of thing. Can you talk about a little bit about that?
Well, the size of the employer, yes, different places have had somewhat different formulas for how to address it, and have there are some places where, for example, building services workers have been included but not hospitality. So there has been some variation. The general intent has been to look at larger employers in the sort of service sector. But there have been kind of, in some cases, there are pre-existing definitions that the locality likes to use to, you know, for example, you have a sick leave law that has a threshold, or, you know, and you're maintaining that threshold.
Okay. Anybody? Yes, Senator Knoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rachel, you mentioned something about technology companies, and they thought that it would be fairly easy to implement something with the software, and you indicated maybe the software is out there and available and accessible. What technologies companies think this would be easy to implement?
I mean, everyone that I've talked to has express that, you know, but they're, I mean, it's an interesting time because they're all competing against each other to present themselves as the ones that can provide the solution to this problem. The, you know, employers are already coming under the requirements of this kind of law in Seattle and San Francisco and elsewhere, so there's already a market out there to promote compliance. But, you know, we work closely with Kronos. There's a company called WorkJam that has some really interesting new solutions that go beyond just the requirements of this bill, but also really promote training opportunities through their app. There's a company called Workforce Solutions, I think. there's... oh, my goodness. I've just come back from maternity leave, so now all of these little wonky names are escaping my mind. But basically, we're in touch with probably 10 or so different, there's Corona, you know, JDA, a bunch of different companies that all have assured us that, you know, it's like push of a few buttons and it can be done. I mean, I'm sure some are more advanced than others, right? But
sure.
It's the gist.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Hello. How are you?
Good. Chairwoman Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Camberling, and I'm here speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I have been before you a couple times on this bill, and I kind of want to take a little bit of a shift and use what Ms. Deutsch was saying as a jumping off point for what I have been seeing in my own practice as an employment attorney. And that is a humongous shift in the way that employees earn money these days. Minimum wage just doesn't cut it anymore. It is no longer a living wage, and workers are having to piece together multiple jobs. And it's been given this fun acronym or fun nickname of the gig economy. And it is basically been touted as this lovely idea that workers can piece together multiple types of employment to earn as much money as they feel like. It gives the illusion of flexibility, it gives the illusion of choices, and it gives the illusion of control. But what I have seen in people coming into my office is that these are nothing more than illusions. It's a veneer. What's really underneath is people who are struggling to pay bills at the end of every month. They are attorneys who can't find a full-time job, so they're doing contract work and driving for Uber at night. They're people who need to work at Target and at multiple other retailers just to keep food on the table at the end of the month. And this bill is one of the ways in which we can start to strengthen the parachute out there for these workers who need some kind of flexibility and some kind of stability, because at this point, this is the option. The option is to take all these jobs and piece them together to make a living wage. And when you give somebody some kind of predictability and how they're going to be able to earn that living, they can then, you know, schedule a shift with Uber, or they can then schedule another shift with another employer, because unfortunately, it doesn't look like our economy is going to go back to 40 hours a week. You get benefits, you're a full-time employee, and you're earning a living wage. And so when the people come into my office saying, I'm unable to make ends meet because my employer arbitrarily cut me down to 5 hours a week to keep me on payroll, but if I try to say I can't work a certain shift that they promised me, I get fired. Or if I have to go, the one I actually just saw, somebody had a disability and needed a certain doctor's appointment every week in order to deal with that disability, and was terminated from employment because the employer said, I need you to work on that particular day, and this worker said, I can't. I have a disability. I have to go to my doctor, and was subsequently fired. And so there are the protections in place, but I think we need more, and that's what this bill does, is provide more protections for these employees who have no other choice but to work in these industries that kind of reusable employees, basically, is the way I see it.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming to testify. Thank you, all of you. And thanks for coming. You came all the way from California? Oh, well, welcome, and thank you for coming. Okay, so we would like to bring up.
Maybe they're watching.
Maybe they're watching. Betsy Earle, Sean Miller, and Chris Gerard, if they can miraculously appear. Chris Gerard's here. We'll have you go ahead and give a start. And Betsy Earle's and Sean probably are going to. Here they're coming. But you get first. You get first dibs here, sir. Why don't you go ahead and introduce
yourself? I've never performed a miraculous feat before.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, committee members. I'm Chris Gerard, CEO of Plaid Pantry and Chair of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. This bill seems to be aimed at businesses that have a lot of people under one roof with multiple people cross-trained and available to swap and fill in when people get sick and things like that. Most convenience stores have one person on a shift most of the shift, and each individual store just has a few employees who are already pretty tightly scheduled, and they're all full-time unless somebody comes to work for specifically wanting part-time. So the provisions in here for swapping and coordinating among employees for shift changes just doesn't work, probably in a lot of other small businesses too. I submitted written testimony. I hope you had a chance to look at it. I won't repeat it, but I would like to emphasize that most of our schedule changes are requested by employees, and most of those are within the two-week period. So it seems like this bill has kind of a catch-22, because we have an employee that's sick or has a child that's sick or has some schedule change that comes up within the 2 weeks when we write the schedule. But that employee-requested change now becomes an employer-requested change under this bill, and we're penalized for replacing that person that when we're trying to accommodate our employees' needs. And we're very good at doing this because we have a pool of people, not in one store, but in other stores where the managers can coordinate and find somebody who is on their day off or wants the extra hours and can fill it in. As I read the bill, we get penalized for doing that when, in fact, in a company like ours and other small businesses, you have to coordinate to find people in other stores. So the employee, number one, it's not reasonable to expect a sick person to find somebody to fill in for them, we don't think. And furthermore, when you just have a small staff in one store, management has to get involved to help find a replacement to cover the shift. There's exceptions in this bill, and maybe they apply to us in Section 2. And if so, I guess we're okay with it. It refers to having a detrimental effect on the business. Well, if we have one person on duty and that person doesn't show up or they get sick and can't come in, it's pretty detrimental if you close the store. So it's a short-term need that management would have to get involved, and we have people who would volunteer to do that. They would like to have the extra overtime. But with these restrictions, we're going to have to, when requests come up for accommodation, we're going to have to say no to avoid a penalty. And the people that do want the extra pay, usually at an overtime rate, are not going to get the extra pay. Another concern is offering hours to existing employees. Almost all of our hiring, we're a first job, and many small businesses are. We're a first job for a lot of people. So they come in, and most of the hiring is entry-level positions. And then people gain experience and either move up in the company or take that valuable experience that they got with us, and they go find a job someplace else where they can climb up a different ladder. So on those two points, those are the two main points, I'd ask for an exemption for employee-initiated changes to the schedule. In other words, if an employee within that two-week schedule, we wrote a schedule, but then they say, oh, I've got a sick child or I have this event I have to go to, if that initiates it and we have to find a replacement, we'd like to not be penalized for accommodating that employee request. And the other exemption we'd like to see is for entry-level positions, because there's no way to share. We hire specifically for somebody new coming in the door to go through training. It's not like we would go pick somebody else since everybody else is already working full-time if they desire it. We have other concerns with the bill. It's a horrendous administrative burden. But our greatest concern is our employees with short-term requests that we go out of our way to accommodate. We don't question it. We accommodate almost every request. We aren't going to be able to do that now. So the bill, ironically, we're trying to get stability and predictability for the employees. This is going to make it worse for our company and a lot of other small businesses because we're not going to be able to accommodate in the interest of avoiding the penalties on this. So I hope you can really look at those. There's a lot of small businesses in that bucket. Thank you for hearing my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Okay. Sean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and particularly the Oregon Retail Council. AOI and the Retail Council remain concerned about Senate Bill 828, regardless of the changes that you've heard about in the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. And I have spoken with you before about the bill, so I will just cover a few of the things that we're most concerned about that are in the amendments. The first section that I wanted to talk to you about is under provisions for all employers. And our main concern here is the provision that allows employees the right to provide input into their schedules. Proponents have said to you that employers don't have any, there's no requirement on employers to grant these requests. But I would like to point out that the bill does create an unlawful employment practice claim if the employer discriminates against an employee for making this request. And I have to tell you, obviously, that sounds entirely reasonable. But this is where it gets extremely tricky for an employer, because if the employer denies the request and the employee later on perceives that they have been discriminated against, they can file a discrimination claim. And proponents described at the beginning of this testimony the penalty and enforcement provisions in these amendments as boilerplate bully enforcement. But I can absolutely assure you that if you are the employer having to defend a claim like that, that part of the law doesn't feel much like boilerplate. Simply receiving a bully complaint is stressful and expensive for employers of all sizes. Responding to one of these complaints can cost thousands of dollars if the employer can afford to hire an attorney. If not, they do the best they can, but it's still a stressful process. I practiced law for several years in between my lobby gigs, and this was one of the most stressful times that I ever saw for employers, is when they received bully discrimination complaints. So I think minimizing the enforcement provisions in this bill, just because we look at them every day, is unfair and probably insensitive to the employers that are having to deal with things like this on a daily basis or even just once in a while. The other thing I wanted to point out for you is under provisions for large employers, the amendments actually make the bill somewhat worse from our perspective. The original bill defined large employers as those that had 25 employees plus 100 employees nationwide. And as far as I understand it, the amendments just make a large employer an employer that has 25 or more employees. So they've dropped the 100 employee nationwide provision. That's not a big employer. There's nothing big about that, even in a small employer state like Oregon. That sweeps in many, many more retailers than in prior versions. And many businesses this size in this state and others don't have access to or use the kind of scheduling software that has been referred to here as it pertains to the large employer sections and large retailers. Businesses at 25 or 30 employees in this state very often don't even have a full-time human resources department. They frequently have one employee, frequently the owner or manager, who is doing the scheduling for all of their employees as well as possibly other tasks. In one of these situations, scheduling employees under this bill would not be a matter of pushing a few buttons to make some software changes, as a prior witness has testified. Those are just a couple of the things that I think are the most concerning about the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments, and I will leave some of my other concerns aside and let Mr. Miller and other witnesses take over.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to Senate Bill 823 and the Dash 3 amendment that I had a chance to look over this weekend and briefly this before the hearing, the Dash 4, both of which do not change our position whatsoever on the bill, and we would strongly oppose 828. Just to cover a few items in the bill, I think that Betsy mentioned the 25 employee threshold. You know, we believe there's many things within the bill that make it worse, but that also brings in a lot of your independent grocers from small towns across the state under this definition. I think a lot of the same concerns that Chris outlined, we would definitely have those same concerns. As for two other provisions, and again, I testified to this in our original testimony, so I won't go through it again, but I do want to mention again, there's two provisions that are not in the bill or the amendments, and that is, and I know it was mentioned from the prior panel on page 16, dealing with on page 16, dealing with the legislative intent, dealing with the collective bargaining and the additional remedy. This is not a collective bargaining agreement exemption. And again, many of our stores that do collective bargain with UFCW and other unions, these are scheduling is part of the negotiating table. It's something that it is, again, collectively bargained by employers and the employees that work there, and it is a component of that bargaining table, and we believe it should continue to be so. And so the bill does not have that exemption, and the amendment does not have the exemption in it. Another thing that the amendment does not have is any form of local preemption. You know, again, we are, you know, would like to have, and again, we can have these debates on the statewide level, but it seemed like we're leveraged between some local governments and the state going back and forth on who can be more stringent on some of these employer-related laws. And so, you know, again, you know, without a some form of preemption, collective bargaining agreement, and a lot of the other issues outlined in today's in this panel, we would continue to be opposed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. I just have a quick question for Mr. Girard and for you, Sean. So for some of the things that are in the bill now, such as the two-week schedule, fair estimate, things like that, can either of you talk about what common practices are? Or I don't exactly know how the plaid pantries work because of the fact that, you know, obviously it is such a different model of having one person in the store, and but it seems like there's always someone there. So,
well, we're very good at accommodating our employees' short-term requests.
I'm trying to think of the things that are already in the bill that you already do versus what you don't do.
Sure. We actually already prepare a two-week advance schedule. Our pay periods are on two-week periods. So it's very easy to write a schedule, Madam Chair. And unlike, I guess there are some businesses that fluctuate a lot, but when you have one person on duty, I mean, we have some stores that have two people on duty, and we have gas pumpers at some stores, but
in general,
things
like the schedule, like knowing how many hours per week or per month, the amount of shifts be given, this type of thing, is that something?
We offer everybody full-time, 40 hours a week, unless they specifically, and we have quite a few people that just want to work on the weekends as a second job. And some of those have been with us for 20 years, just working two shifts on the weekend. So we would welcome that. But in general, we like to have full-time people. Everybody's paid above the minimum wage. Everybody has full benefits, including affordable health coverage, vacation, retirement, 401k. I mean, we want full-time people. So we write the schedule. We can always use somebody full-time. We have a lot of these floaters who say, hey, if a shift opens up, I'd like to have an extra shift. So we've got some people that would probably work 80 hours a week. We don't like that, and we don't do that. But
all right, thank you. And so, yes. Sean, so you're obviously, I know you, can you go through everyone you're representing here today? So Fred Meyer.
So the Northwest Grocery Association is made up of the various chains and independents as well.
So everyone can understand.
Yeah, and so they're different. And again, some are covered by collective bargaining agreements, some aren't. And so I think it is going to vary depending on the employer. So for me to give you, you know, I'm happy to get some more information individually, but I can tell you from a posting standpoint, they post the schedules, and their goal is to accommodate their employees because those are the people that are working, you know, working with the customers. And so that's the objective.
Okay, that's fine. We can talk about it more later. I'm just trying to understand. Okay, thank you, Wallace.
Wait,
before you leave, does anyone have any questions? Okay, thank you. So now we're going to go ahead and bring up Sarah Jonitis. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Jonitis. Amber Tamayo and Rosalyn McCallard, please. And then after that, we'll bring up Scott Winkles and Bob Babbitt. And I guess we'll stick with that for now. So, hello, welcome. Who would like to start?
I'll start. Okay. Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knopp, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Jonitis, and I'm the Director of Social Responsibility for New Seasons Market. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of fair and predictable schedules. New Seasons was founded on the idea that business can be a force for good, serving our staff, our communities, and our planet as part of growing a healthy business. We opened our first store 17 years ago, and today we have 18 stores in Oregon, over 3,000 employees, and we are one of the state's largest private employers. Our success proves that triple bottom line values can align with building a successful business enterprise. At New Seasons, we believe that the people who work for us are our greatest asset. They are the reason our customers shop with us and remain loyal to us year after year. And we know from firsthand experience that when workers have fair and predictable scheduling, families thrive and businesses succeed. That's why we're proud to support Senate Bill 828. While opponents of Fair Workweek legislation claim that these common common sense workplace protections would hurt retail businesses, our company's track record of success proves that the opposite is true. When we were founded back in 2000, New Seasons enacted a lifestyle scheduling policy that provides our staff with many of the same protections that would be extended to tens of thousands of Oregonians should this important legislation be passed. Our staff members are scheduled to work no more than 5 days in a row with at least 2 consecutive days off and at least 12 hours of rest between shifts. Schedules are posted 2 weeks in advance, and in addition, all shifts are for at least 4 hours. The reasons for these policies are simple and the results speak for themselves. First and foremost, we deeply care for our staff and their countless contributions to our business. We believe they deserve predictable, regular schedules so that they can take care of their families, spend time with their loved ones, take care of business at home, and rest and recover for their next day at work. We also know that these policies have benefits beyond our employees' lives. New Seasons experience shows that when retail employees have predictability, they are more engaged, more productive, and more likely to stay. 25% of our staff have been with us for 6 years or more, and we have one of the lowest turnover rates in the industry. To put it simply, when our staff thrives, so does our bottom line. We are proud to stand with the many businesses and organizations around the state who believe in a fair work week for all Oregonians. We strongly encourage you to pass Senate Bill 828. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, thank you. All right, just go down the line here, I guess. Okay.
Thanks. Do I need to do this?
Yes.
I'm pretty loud anyway. Okay. All right, so thank you for hearing me.
Welcome.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Rosalind McCallard, and I am the co-owner of Snackrilege Vegan Sandwich Company and member of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. Snackrilege is a wholesale vegan sandwich company carried in stores across Oregon. We actually just got into New Seasons. Super excited about that. And we've been in business for about 3 years now. I'm here today to offer my support of SB 828. When we opened our business, we decided that one of the things that was most important to us as employers is providing a good, stable work environment for our employees. We can't do as much maybe as some of the other big businesses, like offer trips or things like that, but we do as much as we can. And one of the things we do is offer stable hours. We have 3 employees. We just hired a new person. Our oldest employee or longest employee has been with us since we started. We offer a set schedule, even in times of when we had that big snow, I still offered, we paid for Lyft to and from work so our employees could get their hours, and I paid someone an Uber to drive me around in the snow to deliver the sandwiches so they could still get their hours, because it's something that's really important to us as a company. They feel valued, and I feel good about treating them well. It's a win-win. SB 828 affects only those businesses that aren't treating their employees well. Most of the business owners I speak to in my deliveries understand how investing in the lives of our employees is an investment in our business. This bill feels like a no-brainer, but I know you are all hearing that these accommodations will be so hard on business, and I'm here to tell you that's just not the case. We must allow people to rest between shifts and accommodation for school and childcare if we want to support our employees. We are living in a time where many things are uncertain, and I believe as a small business owner, this is the least I can do to support our staff. I was a student working 2 jobs just a few years ago, and I understand how hard it is to move up and become an entrepreneur. SB 828 helps folks who want to remain in their industry get the hours they need to live, but also to grow in their professional experience. Rather than hiring people from outside the company to have a bunch of part-time staff, I think it is important to grow the leaders we already have within our company. Asking businesses that avoid giving employees this opportunity is wrong, and in many cases they are doing this for nefarious reasons, to avoid paying benefits or worse, keeping people in the poverty cycle. I urge you to support SB 828, not only because it is the right thing to do, but because these abuses do occur in some businesses, and I think that asking these businesses to do the right thing and treat their employees well is easy. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of SB 828.
Thank you. How many employees do you have?
So we have 2 right now. We just hired a 3rd one yesterday, so 3.
Congratulations.
The most we had is 7 when we had a food cart, but too much. It's too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chairwoman Taylor and members of the committee. My name is Amber Tamayo, and I'm a co-owner of High Ridge Construction and a board member of the Main Street Alliance. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of SB 828. Like many small business owners in Springfield, I have worked very hard to start my business. The construction industry can have big highs and lows. Sometimes we are flush, and other times we are penny pinching, but that's the name of the game. Senate Bill 828 isn't a challenge for the business community, though. It's common sense. You may ask yourself why I would be supportive of a bill that doesn't seem to directly affect the construction industry. However, I believe everyone working hard within our community, regardless of industry or trade, contributes greatly to our growing economy. If people are not given the opportunity to be financially stable and earn a living wage, then every industry suffers due to lack of consumer confidence. These workers need to know when they can spend money and when it's time to save. If an employee has a fluctuating schedule, working unfair hours, and when needing time off to care for family, which is then used as leverage to threaten their employment, how are they supposed to plan financially to care for their families? How would they be able to afford to pay for a home repair, a new dress, a pair of shoes, or a car repair? This is how every business benefits from these practices. If my services are not needed, then I can't take my family out to eat and support the restaurants or coffee shops in my community. SB 828 addresses practices that I myself have experienced before I was a business owner. Some of these practices were the very reason I decided to work for myself in the first place. I spent 20 plus years in the restaurant industry, and let me tell you, these unfair practices do happen all the time. Most experiences I had were when I was working for large chains, and so I believe that the recent amendments to the bill will cover those big corporations that have forgotten that their employees are humans, with families to care for, college dreams, and health needs. But I believe it's all businesses' responsibility to ensure that fair work practices are being upheld and companies are accountable to create a work environment that works with employees and their busy lives. We can work together and make sure Oregonians achieve financial stability with a focus on families and in return have a quality of life that builds a strong community where all prosper and support our local economy. In closing, I respectfully request your support for SB 828. I believe it's good for business and my community as a whole. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so next we're going to bring up Scott Winkles and Bob Bubbitt and hear what they have to say. And then after that, I understand that Kevin Frazier is here. And so we'll have him come up along with, we have three different panels of that people who are supporting the bill that are on, that have signed up to testify. I'm going to have all of you kind of get together and maybe pick out, some of you maybe pick out four of you that can testify. I'm concerned about time first up. So why don't you guys get together and talk about that a little bit about who you want to have come up. So Carly, maybe I could ask you to lead that charge. Oh, sorry. You can, here's the sign-up list. So, okay. Hello.
Thank you. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and we do have some continued concerns with this piece of legislation. I think we would narrow those concerns down to Section 9 of the bill, which is the section entitled Employee Right to Input in the Work Schedule. The challenge that Oregon's public employers would have with this is that we negotiate our contracts under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, wages, hours, terms, and conditions of employment, to include work shifts and work locations, are mandatory subject to bargaining. The challenge that this creates is that we've created now an expectation that the employee will be able to request these work shifts from their employer. However, for the employer to honor those would be problematic, given that we bid shifts and locations and many of the enumerated items in subs A through K through seniority. And so we're going to put up a poster in a conspicuous location, our employment spot, for a request that the employer probably is in all likelihood going to have a hard time meeting and comply with their collective bargaining agreement. So, for instance, if an employee wanted an employer was going to request a certain location, the appropriate way to do that would be through the bidding process, and that would be done based on seniority. Creating these requests we've created a problem in the workplace where the employer is going to be in a position where they are obligated to say no in many of these instances, because to grant them would be prohibited under the CBA. We would respectfully submit that this is not an appropriate requirement to be placed on an employer when we're negotiating and have already determined how these positions are typically assigned and granted. Additionally, it doesn't specify in this bill what constitutes a shift. And if the employer were to grant this request and it's a normal, reoccurring change in schedule, I believe that would constitute a shift. And a more senior employee in the bargaining unit could then exercise bumping rights and remove that requirement. I don't think that's what's intended, but it's not specifically addressed in the bill, nor are the other interactions with PECBA. And we would respectfully submit that that should be addressed if this legislation is to go forward.
Okay, so just to clarify, Scott, so if this change were to occur that you're bringing to our attention, would you be okay with the bill then?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Chair Taylor, yes.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll just say two things real quickly. One, ditto to what Scott just said, so okay. I won't repeat any of that.
Okay.
I think, just to put a bug in your mind, I suspect that those that are in support of this legislation are largely coming from the private sector. I could be wrong, but I don't think you're going to hear a whole lot of public sector, public employees coming to you asking for at least Section 9 of this bill, because the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act and collective bargaining agreements really address those issues. So I think at least my client, and I suspect his client, would be happy if you just essentially not withstood Section 9 for public employers covered under PECBA.
Yeah, no, I was just asking the question. I think we're just having the conversation today to understand. I wanted to just have on the record what folks were for and against. Thank you both for thank you for coming.
Chairwoman Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Frazier, representing Children First for Oregon. Children First for Oregon is the primary source for data on the well-being of Oregon's 860,000 kids. Our program, United for Kids, works with partners like the UFCW, Local 555, to make Oregon the best place to be a kid. It's been said that life is what happens when you're making other plans. This quote is particularly applicable to the 640,000 parents of children under 18 that are working in the state's workforce. The unpredictability of life applies to the 65.1% of Oregon mothers of children under the age of 6 that work as well. When time at work is unpredictable and uncertain, time at home is curtailed, childcare costs increase, and the work-life balance is tipped heavily in the direction of work. Children First for Oregon supports this legislation because low-income workers typically face the most unpredictable schedules. And 26% of irregular or on-call workers report frequent work-life conflicts, such as having to reschedule appointments and find last-minute childcare. I grew up in Oregon. I grew up in a well-off family, and I grew up with, in my opinion, the world's best mom. Surely the fact that she was able to stay home with me and my twin sister during childhood played a big role in that bond. Surely the fact that she was always on call for when I was sick at school or just wanted to go home made my education that much easier. Surely her most important gift to me was her time. Too many other parents in Oregon do not have that luxury. Their schedule's set, and they have to weigh caring for a sick child and providing for their family. In other words, they have to make an impossible choice. So when you think about Senate Bill 828, please think about Oregon's children and their parents so that they can have enough time with their kids.
Okay, thank you. All right. Sorry about that. Usually we have proponents and opponents at different times, but thank you for being flexible and coming up together. Sorry about that. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and call up Paul Raynor, Tia Raynor, and Alex Sherrod. So. Or maybe just the two of you.
Tia,
that's okay. Well, we'll go ahead and bring up Mark Helen? Oh, Tia. This is me. This is Tia.
No, she had a run down the hall.
Mark, want to go ahead and come up? Sure, that would be great.
Hello.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Thank you for coming to the Capitol today. Just say your name, please, for the record. Who'd like to start?
Mark, go first. Yeah.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Halen. I'm a bartender in Southeast Portland, and I really strongly urge you to vote for Senate Bill 828. It is a very rampant problem. I've been in the industry for 10 years. I've spoken to you briefly, Chair Taylor, about a week ago about this. sorry. And a year ago, I had a wonderful full-time job bartending at a Timbers pub in Southeast Portland. And I had asked for my Thursday night shift to be switched to either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. I had talked to the other bartender, and they were all right with it. I then asked the manager if that was okay, and they said it was totally fine. And I was heavily retaliated at for it. I came in the next week to find that I had gone from 40 hours to 12 on days that I normally wasn't available. They claimed it was because we were going to be slow in January that was going to happen. I kind of rolled with it for 1 week, and then it happened again the next week with, again, different schedule, different hours, 12 hours a week. Nervous.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
You're doing great.
Within 2 weeks, though, they had hired a new bartender to fill in all of these blank hours that they then needed to fill because they had cut mine back so hard. They eventually made that person, after 2 more weeks, into the bar manager and gave them scheduling preference. And they would fail to post the week-long schedule even a day in advance, like we finish on Saturday night, and there would be no schedule for the next Sunday morning even posted. My schedule would constantly change about 3 or 4 times a week. I would always hear complaints from my coworkers that that they had, within 12 hours notice, changed the schedule. My most intense version of that was apparently there was a big band in town, and my manager had decided 15 minutes after my schedule had ended that the schedule had changed but had not been posted, and I had to work another 8 hours. They wanted me to have full availability because I was fighting to try to get anything more than 12 hours a week, but they still would not give me anything. With the constantly changing schedule, I could not budget or plan or have any plans for the future at all because I may be working right now and didn't even know I was supposed to be there. I did end up finding another job, so I luckily got out of there. They wouldn't let me do the two-job thing because having 3 shifts a week somewhere else was too busy to schedule around, so they just cut my hours to 0 for 11 weeks before taking me off the schedule. I know that not all managers, by a long shot, abuse their power. It's just that there's no way to keep them from doing them as the law is written right now. And so our Senate Bill 828 would be really, really amazing because there's currently all of, like, freedom and security for a business owner and a schedule maker, but there's absolutely none for any workers. And I just want to find a nice balance between the two. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have any questions, I'm glad to answer.
Okay. Just move down the line here.
Good afternoon, Chairpersons Taylor and committee members. My name is Alexander Sherrod, and I urge you to support Senate Bill 828. I work at a hotel in downtown Portland. In the month of January and early February, my schedule changed 3 times. I went from working 6 days a week to 7 and then back to 6. So I didn't really have very much free time in that period since I was working so much, but with a little free time I had, I couldn't do anything because my schedule kept changing. And I assume we all know how demoralizing it can be to have no control over your life at that point. I plan on going back to college to get a degree because who wants to work at a minimum paying job their whole life? How can I achieve my goals if my employer is not willing or required to give me a solid schedule for 2 weeks? I'm a hard worker. I pride myself on my work ethic. Do I not deserve some sort of heads up? How can I plan my life around my job when I don't even know when I'll be working in a week? I have a, not a severe medical condition, but it's a genetic disease. And I had to undergo a pretty severe surgery when I was in California. I worked in San Francisco, which they actually had something similar like this at the time. So that was pretty helpful when I would try to schedule my surgery. But even now, I have to go down every 6 to 8 months to have another operation done so I don't get cancer in 20 years or so. And it's kind of awkward and uncomfortable having to explain to my employer that, hey, by the way, you know, in 6 months I have to go down for a week or so I can have this done. And it's not like I have to tell them what's going on, but it makes it a lot easier when I explain that I have this medical condition, because it's like, oh, I'm not just going down there for fun, you know, sun and whatnot. It may not seem like much, but knowing what's going on is a great feeling, and I think every Oregonian deserves it. Thank you.
I'm sorry. That sounds like a tough time there. Sorry about that.
Hello, Chairman Taylor. Chair people, well, other people, Senate committee. Sorry. Hi, my name is Paul Rayner, and I work at a hotel in downtown Portland, a union hotel, and I've been there about 11 years, so I've got some seniority, pretty much a set schedule, and I'm one of the lucky people, being the top half of a seniority in a collective bargaining hotel. The other half, the low half, they have no say on when they're going to work. Schedule's always changing, and you're hearing everything from having to choose between dental appointments, doctor's appointments, or making it to work on that day. And the worst thing I hear is parents. This week, Adrienne at work, she's a cashier. She had to quit job, a nice would-be union job with medical, because she couldn't get consistent days off to get consistent child care. Whether she's using her mom, a standard daycare provider, it didn't matter. She couldn't afford drop-in daycare. She was in such an awful situation. She had to lose potentially a good living wage job so she can take care of her kid. She can't leave her kid at home. She can't bring the kid to work. What choice does she have but to go work a minimum wage job where maybe she had a chance to get her child care problem taken care of? I got married in August. Tia and myself were talking about children, but what scares me is, even though I have a union job with seniority, Tia has zero protection. So when we have kids and Tia goes back to work after maternity leave, who's going to take care of our kids? Now, where I'm Monday through Friday, she's all over the place, sometimes copening, sometimes a stretch of 7 days working AM, then PM, sometimes not working at all for weeks. I don't want my kid not to know who's going to raise him. I don't want to have to worry about who's going to take care of him. I want to be able to go for the next 6 months and go, okay, Junior's all taken care of. That's why I really support this bill, because I've seen so much in the 31 years I've been working in this industry, and I'd like to see it changed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you for coming and sharing your stories. Okay, we're going to go ahead, and I see John Rakowitz is in the audience, if he wants to come up, and I don't see Mr. Chandler, so we'll...
I think he's up.
If he's right there, we can... is Anthony Smith in the audience? Okay, we'll go ahead and start with you, Mr. Rakowitz.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, John Rakowitz with the Associated General Contractors. Our members include a broad cross-section of commercial contractors across the state. What the majority of our members have in common is that they're typically smaller businesses, and they're highly mobile, moving from job site to job site where the work is. We have submitted testimony opposing the bill based on our understanding of the Dash 3 amendments. In particular, sections 9 through 17 where it appeared to apply to all employers, regardless of size or industry type. It now appears, according to the proponent's first panel, that record keeping does not apply to all employers. However, I would point to Section 11, Subsection 3, where it still reads to us to apply to all employers. So perhaps that's simply a matter of clarifying the language in that section. It just looks that way to us. The other sections that do apply to all employers and therefore construction include Sections 9 and Sections 12 through 16. In particular, Sections 12 through 16, we would just underscore and restate Betsy Earle's statement earlier that that is not simply boilerplate. Starting with Section 9, an employee would have the right to request certain schedule changes, including telecommuting, job sharing, and changes to start or end times for the workday. That obviously doesn't work when you're trying to build a construction site. In the construction industry, our employees understand when they join us, they're going to have to go to where the work is, just like the contractor does. Given the different job sites, the project timelines, our industry, it just doesn't lend itself to this sort of schedule request and changes. So that's a particular issue for us. In particular, though, that portion becomes especially problematic when taken in conjunction with the retaliation portion of the bill, Section 12, where it creates an unlawful practice for retaliation any term of employment of employees based on their inquiry about schedule changes. This fear of an unlawful practice claim would directly interfere with our employees' ability to make necessary day-to-day and sometimes hour-to-hour changes that all construction site job sites demand. So in the interest of the committee's time, I've submitted written testimony that explains in more depth why it doesn't work for industry, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to have folks on standby before you start, I will have Beth Cook come up next, Trudy Bennett, and Melody Gramley, and then also on standby to have Nick Fellin and Megan Vink Mulder. We have about 17 more minutes, so we'll try to get everybody in.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Smith. I'm the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents nearly 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small business. And I'd ask that you keep in mind that NFIB represents businesses in every industry of Oregon's private sector, including restaurant, retail, and hospitality. And while a majority of our members have fewer than 25 employees, actually several hundred NFIB members in Oregon employ more than 25 employees, and that accounts for thousands of jobs for Oregonians. We surveyed our members last year on this issue, and an overwhelming 92% of respondents opposed scheduling mandates on private sector employers, including requirements that employers provide work schedules at least 2 weeks in advance, as well as requiring them to pay predictability pay if a work shift is changed or canceled under certain circumstances. Provisions in the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s that still apply to employers with just 25 employees located anywhere in the state. You'll find my additional comments in OLIS, but I just want to underscore some of the issues that have already been brought up, particularly by the business owner who had the convenience stores. You know, NFIB represents small businesses who are franchisees, owners of small regional chains. And the large employer provisions in Section 3 of both amendments lump those small businesses in with big corporations if they employ 25 or more employees anywhere in the state. While these businesses may externally appear to be part of a large national chain, they're often independently owned and operated. Many, if not most, of these small businesses are locally owned, and they may have far fewer than 25 employees working at each business location. Imagine a retail business that has three locations, one in Portland, one in Medford, one in Bend, each with nine employees. Each of these locations operates like a single small business, but they actually share a common owner. Due to the distance between locations, the employees that work at each location only take shifts at their home location, yet the employer has a total of 27 employees in the state and would be considered a large employer under the definitions of the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s. Again, Oregon small businesses overwhelmingly oppose the state's involvement in workplace scheduling. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. When a previous version of this bill was introduced in the 2015 session on the House side, I think my testimony consisted of bafflement as to how it might apply to construction. I'm slightly less baffled now, but the bill in front of you with the Dash 4 still presents some significant concerns. Mr. Rakowicz has already spoken to a variety of them, but particularly for us, the interplay of Section 9, Section 11, and then the enforcement sections 12 through 16. If Section 9 is intended to simply state that employees can talk to their boss about a variety of listed items, I suspect not necessarily inclusive list, then that's fine. If somehow that conversation turns into something for which records need to be kept, and I agree with Mr. Rakowicz, Section 11 is not clear that it doesn't apply to small employers as well, or if it then turns into an enforcement case where the employee alleges that they asked a question, the boss didn't treat them well, that causes all sorts of heartburn. In our industry, as Mr. Rakowicz mentioned, it is not only site-specific. Some days you work here, some days you work there, depending on weather, supplies, deliveries. But it's also hour to hour. If your framers are waiting for a window package to show up and the window truck is delayed or the shipment doesn't get made, there's no way to set a schedule that manages to control itself 2 hours out necessarily, much less 2 weeks out. Others have spoken to the merits of the bill in general. Our specific concern is simply that as I read this bill, it still applies to construction. It still applies in a way that would be very difficult for my members, who are primarily small business operators, usually not in the record-keeping business, frankly. Particularly if these conversations happen on a job site where they don't have access to a computer or anything else to write on. They're up on a roof or underneath a foundation. I understand the intent, I believe. I would simply respectfully ask this committee and the proponents of the bill to take into account how it might react with different industries than those listed. And our concern is that the language in front of you still affects, drags construction into this fight, and as all due respect, we'd rather be drugged back out.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. So we're going to go ahead and I'm not seeing folks. I didn't see who's here in the room, so we'll go ahead and bring Nick. Felon and Megan Vinkmolder up, I think. Perfect. And then after that, we'll have Beth Cook. Is Beth here somewhere? Does anybody?
He's unavailable.
She's not available. Okay, fine. Then we will bring up Melody Gramley and Trudy Bennett along with, I guess we'll have Mr. Savaggio come back up in order to. So we can clarify some of the, see if we have any questions to clarify some of the issues that have been brought up. So, okay. Who wants to start?
I guess that'll be me.
Okay, fantastic. So
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Nope, members of the committee, I'm in favor of Senate Bill 828. My name is Megan Vinkemolder. I currently work for Catalan Bread LLC. It's a small company. I'm also part-timing at a pizza place. And I've had a lot of experiences with scheduling issues in customer service industries and the food industries. So I worked a fast food job, and my schedule was changed on my days off, and I was made unaware that my schedule was changed. I was the one disciplined, and I lost income and standing at work. So I also worked for Bon Appetit. I had a boss who decided that I didn't have enough work experience to continue working there. We changed managers, and she canceled my shifts that I had for that week. Didn't put me on the schedule, just no warning, no, you need to find another job. The worst, though, was when I worked at Xerox. I started with a solid schedule with 40 hours a week, and I was told that my job schedule would be changed quarterly. During the busy season, however, which lasted 4 to 5 months, we were expected to work 6 days a week and have a minimum of 14 hours extra overtime per week just randomly added to our schedule. It was not unheard of for people to have 120 hours on their biweekly paycheck. I was expected to have all hours from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. available to accommodate them with no ability to say no due to a need for rest or what have you. Childcare conflicts, school conflicts, they were not given consideration at all. And instead of having an 8-hour solid shift, I was given 2 4-hour shifts with an hour lunch in between. Sometimes they'd ask for only half an hour lunch break on the busy season or 2 to 3 hours when we're slow. I was scheduled to work holidays and weekends, even if it was my scheduled day off. And the hardest part was during the shift changes. I could work 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. on one day and 4 a.m. to 12 p.m. on the next day. My days off were changed with almost no advance notice, and I got less than 24 hours to figure out how I was going to rework my commitments. For many reasons, working these jobs made planning for the rest of my life pretty impossible. And I recently picked up a part-time job at a pizza place to supplement my income, and I just found out this morning that I'm not put on the schedule at all for the week. So, what a surprise. We do need a fair work week. For thousands of workers like me, we all need this. Thank you for your time and letting me explain my story.
Well, thank you for sharing. Hello.
Hello, Chair Taylor. Thank you. Vice Chair Knope and other members of the committee. I am here to support the Fair Work Week Bill, Senate Bill 828, and my name is Nicholas Phelan. A few years ago, I worked providing roadside assistance, which entailed being on call for days at a time, day and night, and commuting to distress calls in Portland, Beaverton, Tigard, Hillsboro, Lake Oswego, Westland, Wilsonville, and sometimes Vancouver, Washington. The job was demanding as it was, but sometimes I would have to cover for other people. One time, another employee left unexpectedly for an extended period of time, and I was told I had to pick up their shifts. This meant being on call for a week straight and not knowing if I would get any sleep because I couldn't miss a call or it could be my job. Near the end of the week, after not getting any rest, I fell asleep while I was driving and hopped a curve and hit a building. And I was lucky that the curb woke me up because it could have been a lot worse. I'm lucky to be here today, and I'm very lucky that I didn't injure or kill anybody else. And I was forced into choosing between my health and a job. And the result was a car accident that could have been much, much worse. So I urge you to pass Bill 828 so this will not happen to anybody else. And thank you for hearing my testimony.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you both for coming up. I just want to make an announcement to everyone who's here today. We really appreciate everyone coming. We have more people. We have several people signed up who are proponents and opponents to the bill, and we won't be able to hear from everybody, so I apologize for that. We're trying to get through, but we have a lot of people who have signed up. So if you've noticed, I'm trying to balance it of bringing up what we call panels of people who are for it and then people who are perhaps opposed to the bill, going back and forth, and so that's what we're attempting to do right now. I'm going to take a little temperature of the committee members. We have 5-6 minutes left. Gail Stevens, who's been the drafter of the bill, is not here. And so I was wondering if we'd like to have Michael Savaggio come up to answer any questions about the content of the bill. There are several statements that have been made, and if anybody wanted to have anything clarified, or we could just go on to the next panel. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask of Mr. Savaggio at this point? Okay. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and bring up, we have several people here from Papa's Pizza Parlor. We'll go ahead and I'm randomly going to pick Nathan Leggett. Is he here? Okay. Oh, come on up. We'd like to hear from you. And then after that, we'll close with either Trudy or Melody from either Melody Gramley or Trudy Bennett. We'll close with you. So we'll let the two of you figure that out. Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you for coming.
All the way from Springfield, but...
Okay, all right, well, you made it. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to thank my brother for driving me up here, though.
Okay.
So,
Can why don't you say your name for the record?
Nathaniel.
Okay.
Leggett.
Okay.
Is there anything else I need to say for the record?
Well, are you here for in support or opposition
I'm
to the
sorry,
bill?
I just haven't done this before.
That's okay. Well, welcome. We like to see someone, a fresh face here in the Capitol. Are you here in support or opposition to the bill?
I'm opposed to it.
Okay. Can you tell us just real quickly why?
Yeah, because at this point, I don't really like the idea of having a solid schedule, especially since I have school I have to attend to. Okay. And eventually, and school schedules don't change, but the extracurricular activities do. So I'm interested a lot in theater, and if I get into a play, sometimes if the director is sick, then we have to reschedule. And if I'm on a solid schedule at work, I want to keep a job. And if it changes onto a day I work, then I'm going to have to miss something I love. And I really enjoy theater and every other activity. Even if people who do sports, things change. And if we can't really fix that, especially with certain things, like, yes, there are some exceptions to getting those days where you can get off really fast. But I just don't find it very fair that we can do that.
All right.
And
thank you. You did a great job. Yeah, thank you for coming. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and bring up the next people. Thanks for coming up. I appreciate it. And so why don't we have Melody Gramley, Trudy Bennett. I guess maybe we have enough time to hear from both of you if you're here. And then we'll conclude after that. Hello. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Just a reminder to say your name, and if you want to share where you're from, that would be great, but you don't have to.
Okay.
So nervous.
It's okay. You know what? We are very scary looking. We try not to be so scary looking. We are happy to have you here. Thank you for coming. It is your capital, just so you know.
My name is Melody Gramley, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 828. I've worked in retail for over 20 years, and I've learned that it's hard to make plans to do things for myself, such as making doctor's appointments, whether it be for myself, my kids, or helping out my daughter with my grandchildren with their appointments. When you don't know what your schedule is going to be, if you put in for time off from work, that can also affect your scheduling by losing hours. Mm-hmm. Brings me to another thing with the Fair Work Week schedule. We have a lot of employees that are only scheduled so many hours, and they're not really guaranteed a lot of hours, but yet we see a lot of new employees coming in and getting hours that could be offered to the existing employees. That makes it really hard for them to be able to make a living that way, if they don't have those hours, that means they need to go and look for other jobs, which is really hard because they don't have a consistent schedule or they don't know what their schedule is going to be like. I've also seen it where doing these clopenings, it's been very hard on fellow employees' health because I have one gal at work that she has lost so much weight because she's not getting enough rest because there's not enough time in between their shifts.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. You did a great job, just so you know.
You did great.
Everyone's done a great job today. It's been very interesting. I really appreciate it.
This is also my first time here.
Welcome. So. You know, it's got to participate in democracy here. This is great.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Trudy Bennett, and I'm here in favor of SB 828. I've worked in retail for almost 10 years. I actually grew up in retail. That's was my first job, and I came back to it thinking, you know, I've worked myself up to a leadership role in the company, and I've noticed that a lot of the scheduling is actually very unfair for most of my fellow associates. I have one person who had to change their availability for school, and they had been guaranteed, they'd been working 30 hours, and they needed one of the days off for school, and they got their hours reduced to 12, and now they had to move back in with their parents, and they can't afford to pay their bills. And an example for myself, I'm the only one working in my household of five. I just had my stepdaughter and her two sons move in with me and my husband, and I've had to request time off to take one of my grandchildren to a counseling appointment, and I was denied the time to take my grandson to a medical appointment. And when I put in the request, I was told, oh yeah, that's fine, we'll work it out. And the day came and they changed their mind and said, nope, actually you have to work. So I wasn't able, we had to cancel his appointment and reschedule it to a time where I knew I was off. And then I had an appointment today, and my doctor wants to see me on April 12th. That schedule's already done. I work that day, so I have to rearrange my medical needs around my work schedule. And it's difficult at being in a leadership role and expected to be there the 40 plus hours a week, and then still trying to be able to make my home life work. Mm-hmm. And I feel that having this bill in place would be helpful, because I would be able to switch a shift with someone that is just as capable as me, that can, they're trained to do everything I can do, so, if not even better. And my other management won't allow the change just because it's me, or my position is required 40 hours. Mm-hmm. And I do the 40 and above, but they won't allow me to switch that out even for medical needs. It's,
yeah, a lot of challenges. Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, that'll be good.
Okay. Well, you're welcome to. If you wanted to add something else, you're welcome to. So.
That's quite all right.
All right. Thank you both for coming up. And thank you, everybody, for coming. We're going to go ahead and close. Anybody have any questions? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 828. And then our next meeting is on Wednesday, April 5th. We'll have work sessions. So everybody wants to, the work sessions will be on Senate Bill 200. 279-398-416 and 712. It's on the agenda, so if anybody wants to contact me if there's any issues with any of those. And then we're going to have public hearings on Senate Bill 1040 and 294. And then we'll have informational meeting on the future of the state workforce with invited testimony from DAS. So DAS is going to come and talk to us about how many employees the state currently has, the wages people make, the status of the CBAs, et cetera. There's a concern about workforce aging out, et cetera, so we're going to start a conversation about that on Wednesday. So the work sessions hopefully will go pretty quickly, unless anybody wants to bring anything to my attention. And then we'll have some brief public hearings on the other two bills and then have that conversation. So, okay. All right. And so I'm going to adjourn the meeting on the Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you all for coming.